I think last time we just touched upon some of the very broad general issues. Coming to something more specific, Shobindo says that the goal of this yoga is transformation. Now, what I was surprised was to read one of Shobindo's letters, almost definitely more than half a century, maybe almost 78 years back, when he writes something which seems to be more relevant today. The letter is where he speaks of the word being used nowadays. The word is being used very casually and in a very general way nowadays. People even use the word transformation when they go to a psychiatrist and come back. That, look, my life was transformed by this so and so. Transformation is not just a momentary change or change in one part of the nature. It's not even some kind of radical conversions. We have a history of some radical conversions all over the world. In every tradition, there is, for instance, in the Indian ethos, the story of the famous robber and murderer by the name of Ratnakar, who converts, his heart undergoes a radical conversion after a brief dialogue with a famous sage, and he changes into a seeker and subsequently becomes a great seer himself. This is the story in Buddhist tradition of another man called Angulimal, who changes radically into Ananda. This is the story in the Christian tradition of, we know Saint Augustine's life, we know Saul of Tarsus. There are many, many such stories which may give an appearance as if this is the transformation Shobindo is speaking of. After all, what can be more radical than a change of heart from a person who is a known killer to somebody who is a paragon of kindness, piety, virtue, godliness, saintliness? This is not the transformation that Shobindo speaks of. He uses the word in a very specific sense, and perhaps it's best to read in his own language, in his own words. Transformation is a word that I have brought in myself, like supermind, to express certain spiritual concepts and spiritual facts of the integral yoga. Supermind. Many people nowadays use the word very casually. Something above the mind is supermind. We don't even know the highest reaches of mind. Even to be truly a rational human being, to live in true reason, not the reason which is dependent on just physical data, but there is a true reason, a true understanding, is itself an effort. And to enter into any of these reaches of the higher consciousness, one may very easily be deluded, like last time we were speaking of, into believing that one has entered the supermind. I've heard even an Indian ascetic, when somebody was asked, there was a lecture going on in Madurai, and somebody asked the Swamiji, tell us about the supermind. He says, oh, that's, what is supermind? It is just, when mind, you go above mind, it is supermind. Obviously, he didn't know what he's speaking about. And sometimes wearing a certain robe helps to give an authenticity. But supermind is not about robes and disguises. All these fall. Those lines of Savitri which are kept open as we enter on a dizzy height where all disguises fail. And the human mind must abdicate to light or die like a moth in that blaze, in that burning blaze. There is a story about Sri Aurobindo. One of the saints in East Bengal, well-known saints of his own time, he was known as Bama Khipa. When one of his disciples asked him about Sri Aurobindo, he said, "Yes, you." He had a way of speaking, and he scolded his disciple. "You who lives in the dirt of ordinary human nature, you have the audacity to bring Sri Aurobindo's name on your tongue. This is how you know the great traditions in India work. You have the audacity to speak so casually about his name." And then this great mystic tells his disciple, "You know, I have seen him cross the gates of the sun from where no one returns." He had seen it in his mystic experience. So the matter was reported to Sri Aurobindo to seek his confirmation, because this is a well-known experience. The Upanishads are full of it. They speak about it. Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa spoke about it. The gates of the sun through which when you pass, you cannot return back. The human mind must abdicate to light or die like a moth. There is all things made with form and name disappear. It cannot exist there. So when Sri Aurobindo was asked about the authenticity of this statement made by the mystic, he said, "Yes, yes, he did see me go, but he didn't see me come back." He is speaking of it as if it's going from Auroville to Pondicherry and coming back. So, because Sri Aurobindo spoke with such humor, with such simplicity, almost the simplicity of a child. But he knew that, you know, these terms are going to be used later. People are going to put all sorts of meanings. So, this letter must be almost in 1930s. People are now taking them up and using them in senses which have nothing to do with the significance I put into them. I don't know in 30s whether really anybody was speaking about it or not, but definitely nowadays there are integral yoga, the word has been already, you know, used, you know, nowadays there is this intellectual property right, so there is a whole group which has patented the word integral yoga. And that has nothing to do with integral yoga. It is a typical traditional mokshavadi yoga. It speaks of liberation, mukti, nirvana, but the word is patented. So, Sri Aurobindo knew about it long back. Transformation, the word is used very casually. "Oh, I had a very transforming experience. I went to this class and they taught us some beautiful breathing techniques, and then, you know, we had a lovely dance with what music, and I came back transformed." It's an uplifting experience, if you like. Maybe for a moment we enter into some sublime reaches of our own subliminal being. We can have trance in which we forget all name and form and experience. Maybe if we are truly marked a great and mighty rare being, we can experience some touch of that, the bliss of Brahman. But all these experiences, individually or put together, do not constitute what Sri Aurobindo speaks of when he uses the word transformation. Purification of the nature by the influence of the spirit is not what I mean by transformation. So we must know the enormity of the task and the beauty and the grandeur of it. Purification is only part of a psychic change or a psycho-spiritual change. The word besides has many senses and is very often given a moral or ethical meaning which is foreign to my purpose. Yoga is not just a moral or ethical life. Leave alone transformation. It does not mean that yoga is an immoral and unethical life, because human mind lives in dualities. So the moment it is told that yoga is not about morality, it says, "Oh, so it's about immorality." But it's neither about morality nor about immorality. Just as when someone asked Sri Aurobindo about the Gita, and he asked him, "What are you saying there? Is it about violence?" He says, "No, it's neither about violence nor about non-violence. It is to rise to a third poise, where both become instruments of a divine action. So here is Sri Aurobindo telling us, what I mean by the spiritual transformation is something dynamic, not merely liberation of the self or realization of the one, which can very well be attained without any descent. It's not about liberation of the spirit, which is involved in matter, finds itself in mind and thought in human nature to extricate it. It's right now mingled and it's caught up in the meshes of human mind, because thus far it has been liberated by the process of evolution, and there are various processes, special methods by which this spirit involved in the mind can be extricated, much like a cesarean section or a painful delivery, and by constantly putting this one single idea in the mind itself can yield to the emergence of the spirit. But transformation is not about that. It's about the play of the spirit in mind and life and matter, which is quite another thing. One can liberate the spirit from the mind and its clutches and leave the nature untransformed. There's a famous story which Sri Aurobindo recounts in one of his letters about a yogi who was on his way with his retinue, and he was a strange yogi of kind, one of his kind, carrying his whole harem with him. And when Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa asked him, "You say you are doing yoga? What is this?" He says, "How does it matter? I have realized the self. This is nature." So Ramakrishna is reported to have said, "I spit on your Vedanta. I spit on your Vedanta." Sri Aurobindo remarks, Ramakrishna was right. But then, if realization of self is the only thing, then the yogi had a point. So it's true that, you know, if it's just a question of removing the spirit from mind, what happens in traditional spirituality, only that much mental discipline or disciplining of the inner being is required, which will facilitate the release of the spirit. Normally we are living a very gross surface life, extremely crude, almost vulgar. So a ethical moral change, a sattvic modification of human nature, it facilitates the process of release of the spirit from the mind. That's all it does. It makes our matter less dense, less crude, little more lighter, little more subtle. But if the spirit were to return upon the mind, heart, life and body and use them as its instrument, that is not possible, because it is still within a narrow and rigid mold. It is still at best a sattvic mold. But the spirit is all freedom. In the Gita there is a grand vision. Krishna is supposed to represent the incarnate divine, and Arjuna asks him, "Who are you?" So he shows a vision in which he reveals himself as Time the Destroyer. For the divine, all is freedom and all is delight. To live in that consciousness and to use this mind, body and life as instruments of that consciousness is the difficult and challenging task Sri Aurobindo places before us. That's why the mother says very clearly that it's a long process. It cannot be done by some few experiences, and in fact she says that all sudden and radical conversions are always suspect. They are useful. Some great experiences, they enrich the consciousness, but nothing more. It is a putting on of the spiritual consciousness, dynamic as well as static, in every part of the being down to the subconscious. It's not enough that the mind may have some kind of light. It's not enough that the heart feels some kind of love and ananda of the divine. It's not enough even that our will is moved by the puja of the divine will. It is also the lower vital, the very body, and down to the subconscious where all our atavistic habits lie as if buried. In fact, this yoga unearths it, if anything. In other yogas they lie buried, and one takes a poise above them. Those things, one sits over them tight, and when one dies finally, one leaves it like a useless cloak. But here nothing is useless. One goes right down to the pit, and all these things are worked upon by the transforming force. Nothing can remain hidden. That cannot be done by the influence of the self, leaving the consciousness fundamentally as it is, with only purification, enlightenment of the mind and heart, and quiescence of the vital. It's not that. So sometimes one feels very strange when Sri Aurobindo is compared to all kinds of enlightenments and awareness programs. It's not about enlightenment. It's not about just some awareness of the self. Anybody who has walked with some steadiness on the spiritual path has these experiences, and plenty of them. Yet transformation is a very, very long task. Nalinda, who for, I think if anybody lived with him for, you know, the greatest number of years, as far as the yogic life is concerned, it was Nalinda. Right from the prison days, he was with Sri Aurobindo, Nalinikant Gupt, and then he comes to Pondicherry, and then he lives with him right up to the end. And he was known as Manasputra, the mental child of Sri Aurobindo. So much so that when someone spoke something about Nalinda, that, you know, he had his own peculiar ways, like everybody in Ashram and Auroville have their own peculiar ways. So somebody raised a question about Nalinda, whether his understanding of yoga is correct or not, and Sri Aurobindo says, if Nalini is not doing my yoga, then who is doing my yoga? And about this Nalinda, when he was on his last moments, when Niruddha asked him, where are you? So he says, a little above the overmind. Decades and decades of intense yoga under the intense direct presence of Sri Aurobindo and the mother. Nalinda could have easily said, oh, supermind I have attained. Now I am only transforming my subconscious nature. We very easily delude ourselves into this belief. If anybody who is into Sri Aurobindo's yoga has a joint pain, take it for granted he is not suffering from arthritis. He is suffering from transformation going on in the inconscient. It's okay, nothing wrong. The Lord has his own ways of teaching us. But the point is that it's a long, long process. We must be armed with unflinching patience and a great endurance, a perseverance that is willing to walk centuries and centuries and millenniums for just this one change. It's a beautiful line in Sri Aurobindo's poem, Krishna. At last I know the meaning of soul's birth into this universe, terrible and sweet. And it ends with very beautiful two lines. For this one moment lived the ages past. The world now throbs, fulfilled in me at last. We should not be impatient. What does it matter? Even 300 years people find difficult. Even if 1,000 years, 10,000 years, this is worth doing. This is worth doing. Worth attempting. Worth losing everything. Worth living. Worth dying. So here is Sri Aurobindo telling us of the enormity of the program. That don't be happy and satisfied just with some experiences, even if they are very high. By transformation, I do not mean some change of the nature. I do not mean, for instance, sainthood or ethical perfection. Not even sainthood. In this yoga, there are no Swamijis, and we all know no saints, definitely. Sainthood is a kind of, nature is given a certain kind of psychic turn. It gets some kind of a psychic light, and influence irradiates into the nature so that the human nature becomes more malleable. It becomes, it through that thick cloak, some bit of that light and love gets infiltrated. That saintliness. But Sri Aurobindo makes it very clear, I do not mean sainthood or ethical perfection or yogic siddhis like the tantrics. There is a whole movement to turn Sri Aurobindo's yoga into a pure tantra. and sometimes the most dangerous kind of tantra. Shobindu's yoga is Vedanta and Tantra combined. There is a Tantra element in it, but Tantra of a very, very different kind. The mother herself is the supreme Tantric here. It is not an ascent merely, but her descent. One needs to have a very, very pure nature inside, open only to her influence, which is a long process. So Shobindu makes it very clear. It does not mean some yogic siddhis like the tantrics. Yogic siddhis, we know there are vital siddhis, anima, garima, lagima, mahima, asta siddhis. In one of the letters, Sri Aurobindo says, it's not about vital siddhis, vyapti and all kinds of thought reading, thought transference. All these, any yogi who has delved deeply into this realm knows it and has them. Or a transcendental Chinmaya body. There are instances in spiritual history like Swami Ram Telanga Swami and some other, where people directly, the human body, the physical body was left behind and disappeared, and they disappeared into some transcendent body. There is a story of Kabir, there are other stories also. There is a story of in Vaishnava tradition, there is a story in Christian tradition of a glorified body, of an ethereal body. So Sri Aurobindo is saying that I do not mean these things. There are such bodies other than the physical body. I use transformation in a special sense. A change of consciousness, radical and complete. Radical. After that there is no falling back. And complete. Down to the minutest details. And of a certain specific kind which is so conceived as to bring about a strong and assured step forward in the spiritual evolution of the being of a greater and higher kind and a larger sweep and completeness than what took place when a mentalized being first appeared in a vital and material world. This we all know. Human beings don't have to be taught to think. They have to be taught how to think. But thought comes naturally to us by the very fact we are mentalized consciousness. But spirituality doesn't come naturally to us. It's something still abnormal. It's something still mystic, foreign. We have to make a great effort. But a supramental change would mean that all that is very, very natural. We live in that consciousness as naturally as we breathe this air. Imagine what would be when a child takes a human body and is conscious of his soul. What would be the problem with the parents when they tell, you are a little kid, better behave. So you will say, you are a kid, you don't know, I am thousands of years old. Mother spoke of such children who are going to come, and she said it's going to be very, very difficult to bring them up because they are going to carry a different consciousness altogether. I know of a 5-year-old child. When his mother was scolding him, this right in front of my eyes, I have seen this child scolding him about something and saying, is this the way you should behave? The child says, is this what mother has taught you to be angry? And he was not wrong. So this is something which, you know, these children, because they spontaneously carry that intuitive knowledge. They don't have to be taught many things which we have to learn from books and labor and struggle and break our heads to understand. They are born with that sense of freedom, joy, the sense of eternity, spontaneously. Light of realization is not the same thing as descent. Realization by itself does not necessarily transform the being as a whole. There is this another concept. Oh, is he a realized being? So realized being is a transformed being. Realized being simply means that the being has become aware of its essential self. And it's the one self in all. But its nature is still the same. It's a cloak. Sri Aurobindo repeatedly says that we have to make a practical distinction between nature and the soul, Prakriti and Purusha. In a sense, they are two sides of one reality. Being is one. We are not only soul, we are not only nature. We are actually a little bit of both. But for practical purposes, it's important to know that at one pole, if we go deep inside, we realize ourselves as the soul. We are conscious of our immortality. And through that soul, we can come in contact with the eternity, which is behind all movement of time. We can liberate through its touch into some kind of static peace of nirvana. We can enjoy the freedom of the vast and the illimitable. But all that is still in some depth and some heights. When we come back to action, we are back to our nature. Some change it does bring, but a modification is not transformation. It may bring only an opening or heightening or widening of the consciousness at the top, so as to realize something in the Purusha part without any radical change in the parts of the Prakriti. It's like our house has many mansions. We know this famous phrase, biblical phrase, and we go into the topmost and the most beautiful part, and so nice. But the lower part is still the same. So we can live in that and believe that we are transformed. There are ways and means. People even withdraw from life. They do not interact. So they don't confront what lies in the lower reaches of our nature. But that's why in Auroville, in Ashram, in Shobindo's yoga, you are forced to confront. You may be sitting quietly. This was one of my first beautiful experiences. When I came to Ashram, I sat around the Samadhi feeling very happy, very peaceful, and closed my eyes. Suddenly I felt some disturbance around me. When I opened my eyes, somebody was telling me, "You are sitting at the wrong place." It took me some time to realize where am I. I was disoriented. So now I can see it was a very nice thing. That time for a while I thought, near the Samadhi, this, I realized you have to confront yourself. Everywhere. You cannot escape. You have a problem inside you. So here is a person pointing out to you, bringing you to the surface and showing you this too is there. Don't be so absorbed inside. I mean, that's how I looked at it later on, not immediately. First reaction was, this man is not even so sensitive. He's disturbing somebody who is sitting deep absorbed around the Samadhi. And he brings me, you know, somebody out like this. How insensitive. Then I realized you are doing a good work. Good divine work. To teach all of us that there is in us many parts which are untransformed. And that is why the mother says the path of this yoga goes through an uncharted territory. You feel everything is fine, very beautiful. You almost feel you have got it. And then something happens. Somebody says just what you don't want to hear. And a telephone comes and everything is upset. And a little fall. And all your ideas that the human body is turning golden. You know, you are made to realize that it's still made of the frail mud stuff. So this is the charm, the danger, the beauty, the unexpectedness, the adventure, and the challenge of this yoga. Shubhendu tells us it's not about some realization. There must be a descent of the light not merely into the mind or part of it, but into all the being, down to the physical and below. So this is another letter, and then there is a third one where Shobindo speaks. He wants us to guard against certain general mistakes with which we confuse transformation. Our yoga aims at the discovery of the supramental being, the supramental world and the supramental nature and their manifestation. Now the problem is these words have become very familiar to us, and we are really not ready to receive these words, but it is our grace. It is their grace that they have released these words into the atmosphere so that at least mentally we can little bit understand. But Shobindo cautions us, but we must guard ourselves against certain general mistakes which are likely to arise. People think that certain powers such as anima, garima, it's to become light, to become heavy, or the control of the physical functions and the capacity to cure diseases constitute the supramentalized physical. He has left no doubts in anybody's mind. If you read through Sri Aurobindo's writings, we'll have no doubts. This capacity to cure by certain magical means, oh, I am getting the super mind and throwing it and the illness is getting cured, it's mostly the vital. So he says, we should guard against these ideas. In many cases, these powers are acquired by persons who happen to open themselves consciously or unconsciously to the subliminal being where these powers lie. There are plenty of cases where such powers are seen in persons who have no idea of the super mind or of yoga. You don't even need to actually do yoga. Sometimes these powers are just released into certain people because of certain kind of constitution, a freak experiment of nature. What the old yogins manifested in their life was largely due to the control of the vital being over physical functions. This is the story of when Sri Aurobindo went to meet this famous yogi Brahmanand on the banks of Narmada. It is said that he had lived 200 or 300 years. Sri Aurobindo did not doubt he must have lived. He says for many, he knew what happened during the Shivaji period and quite possible that he would have lived. But that is not transformation of the physical. That is superimposition of the vital on the physical. It's the superimposition of another, the law of another plane onto the physical, so that for a moment the physical is possessed and overpowered by the vital. Now vital, we all know, can continue to exist for hundreds of years. It's very easy. But for that, one has to cut oneself off from active interchange with the world. You cannot do it otherwise. So these yogis do it. We hear about certain lamas. I have gone to Ladakh, where some of these lamas are, and when I was there in Siachen, I was told that there are lamas. I really went around searching for one. I couldn't find. But I was told that, you know, there are some who, you know, to become a head lama, you have to pass through a very difficult examination. So what is the examination? It's not a scriptural text. But you have to sit on a cold wintry night, you know, on the bank of a river and bare-bodied, and you have to drip the blanket inside the cold water, wrap it around your body, and by the body's heat dry it, and you have to do it a certain number of times, some 21 times or something like that, and then you are qualified to be a lama of that order. Now it may be true, there must be some truth in these things, but that is not transformation. So this is, you have to cut yourself off. You cannot, you have to have your own little monastery, your own little environment which is favorable, in which you live. And the moment you go out, there's a very famous film which had come, I think it was Shangri-La, where, you know, this is shown that within a certain valley, certain thing is experimented upon. But the moment you come out of that, step out, you are prone to all the old problems and you crumble to dust. So our aim is not this attainment of the vital siddhis. There are stories even in the ancient scripture that people, there are yogis and, you know, who have lived for thousands of years. The control of the physical substance and functions through vital force. This is not transformation. What we are attempting to achieve is a complete transformation of our entire being in all its planes of manifestations. In the old disciplines, the goal was not transformation or victory over the physical being. They did not lay any direct hold on it. So this is one. And then finally, another common mistake that we make when we use the word transformation. Because this word has come and is being very used very loosely, transformation, like yoga. Any posture is yoga. By that criteria, all the animals do the best hatha yoga in the world. And, you know, tortoise does the best pranayam because, you know, it breathes only 3 to 5 times in 1 minute. So who can be a greater yogi than the tortoise? But that is not yoga, so similarly transformation is, you must get out of certain wrong ideas that you seem to have about yoga. Shobindo is writing in one of the letters, for these are dangerous. It's not only that these ideas are misleading. Somebody may say, okay, it's all right. What's there? We all have our own freedom to think the way we want to. Shobindo is saying, yes, but know that this is dangerous. So these ideas are dangerous and ought to be thrown away by every sadhak. What somebody does with their life is their business. But if you want to take up Shobindo's yoga, certain ideas should be thrown out of the windows of our mind. Not because Shobindo wants us to think the way he wants us to think. He is simply telling us it is dangerous. So he is just cautioning us. What are those ideas? One, the object of yoga is not to become like Sri Aurobindo or the mother. I have read some books where people even talk about going beyond Sri Aurobindo and the mother. Somebody writes that, you know, Sri Aurobindo stops there now. We are carrying the work forward, transforming the physical. The other things have already been done. We can do away with all that. So these ideas come to make a, you know, megalomania has its own field of expression. So this not to become like Sri Aurobindo and the mother. Several letters Sri Aurobindo writes that it will be otiose, unnecessary to have another Aurobindo. And there are people even in ashram, you know, there are people who like to dress up like Sri Aurobindo, have a beard like him and sit in a posture, you know, so that at least in looks one looks like Sri Aurobindo. So when somebody's leg gets fractured, one can believe that, you know, I am at least limping like Sri Aurobindo. All that is fine. But that is not what Sri Aurobindo expects of us. So it's not becoming like Sri Aurobindo and the mother, that now I am the mother, even after mother's physical, even when she was in a physical body. There was a lady who came, a yogini, who claimed that she is the real mother. And it caused a lot of stir. And you'll be amazed that some even senior sadhaks in the ashram, whose names would scandalize, went to meet her. And after the mother left her body, of course she went, her fate was that she was finally picked up by the police. They discovered some fraud. Then even subsequently, we take these things so casually. So those who cherish this idea, Shobindo is also telling us, those who cherish this idea easily come to the further idea that they can become their equals and even greater. This is only to feed the ego, as simple as that. Shobindo is telling us, this is only to feed the ego. Two, the object of yoga is not to get power. There are two kinds of people who are drawn to yoga. One, who come for knowledge, self-realization, enlightenment, to know the true self, to know truth, to live in truth and by truth. Others who are attracted by the side benefits of yoga, spin-offs, as they say, the byproducts. Byproducts of yoga is powers. I will be able to cure people. I will be able to do miraculous things. People are going to worship me. So this is the reason why certain beings are attracted to yoga. And in the ancient traditions, it is known that the asuric nature are attracted to the powers that they can get out of yoga. But they don't want to go through the way of knowledge. In Shobindo's yoga, first the Vedantic way, then the Tantra. Before one gets the powers, one must be rooted in the true self. Otherwise, they will, you know, it's like trying to lift a great hefty mace, which only a great warrior can lift. One ends up breaking one's own head by it. So it's not running after powers. So he says, the object of yoga is not to get power or to be more powerful than others, or to have great siddhis, or to do great or wonderful or miraculous things. It's a yoga which, you know, one has to, in one place Sri Aurobindo says, if you are not willing to become the ordinary of the most ordinary human beings, then you are not really ready for this yoga. To be willing to be that, look at mother, with all the realizations, with all the powers in her being, She did everything like a very common person. Even Shurpindo, when he came, people used to sit, keeping their feet in front of him. And it is the mother who taught them how to be with the master. They didn't even know that he is the master. He never told anything, and yet he was changing just by the mere presence. And the mother, by her own personal example, taught them. She had no reason to do. She is Shurbindo's equal. She has realized everything that Shurbindo has realized. And yet she taught us how to be in front of the master. So, it's not to do great or wonderful or miraculous things. Three, the object, if somebody is not willing to become ordinary, if one wants to become extraordinary, one gets a blow in this yoga. One should be willing to be like an ordinary human being, and the change will take place very beautifully, sometimes very imperceptibly, but in a very solid way. Three, the object of yoga is not to be a great yogi or a superman. So all this talk about supermanhood. So beautiful, Sri Aurobindo teaches us how to be truly humble. The object of yoga is not to be a great yogi or a superman. This is an egoistic way of taking the yoga and can lead to no good. Avoid it all together, Sri Aurobindo's words. Avoid it all together. So what is supermanhood all about? Supermanhood, like everything else, is the natural consequence of living in the divine consciousness. When we surrender our entire being in the hands of the divine and live by that, when we live for that, when we live in that, when each part and plane of our being is consciously surrendered to that, it becomes a flawless instrument, a pure and perfect channel of that which has no name. Then we naturally enter into a state which some may call as supermanhood. But to become a superman is all the wrong reason for entering into yoga. Four, to talk about the supramental and think of bringing it down in yourself is the most dangerous of all. I had a very interesting experience. There was a session of hypnosis in the ashram in one of the conferences 3-4 years back. So there was a person who was talking, you know, he introduced everybody that, look, people talk about all this, read such books and, you know, but I want to actually show what Savitri is by bringing down that into human beings, everybody. So I was supposed to be the chairperson, and I shuddered when he spoke such words, you know. But nevertheless, I had no choice, I can't run away because, you know, he's already started, it would be impolite. So he put everybody, he was doing nothing but a guided imagery, you know, a lot of people do that. So he started, you know, imagine a golden light, you know, and golden light was coming down and everybody close your eyes and everybody is relaxed. And then, you know, he said, now this is what I was meaning. So, you know, sometimes you have to burst the bubble. So I said, it's very fine, everybody is in trance, but I have to make a small announcement. It's lunch time, so those who want to go can go, others can remain. Within moments, within moments, everybody came back from the supramental to the to the very, very mentalized physical state. So this is necessary because, you know, people get into all kinds of fads. There are fads that if I don't eat, I'll become supramental. So for many days, people don't eat. Then they have a breakdown. And then, you know, I have to take care. So, you know, prevention is better than cure. Sometimes, you know, they lose sleep and they think they are being supramentalized. So all kinds of ideas are there. Sri Aurobindo has told us it's the most dangerous of all. It may bring an entire megalomania and loss of balance. In fact, when mother was asked in late 60s, she's saying, do not pull, give yourself. Do not pull, give yourself. I am pulling the supermind in some intense concentration. If at all supermind were to come down, we will vanish. Thank God it doesn't come down. Even little bit of that vital forces come down and we lose our balance. So, she says, he says it's megalomania and loss of balance. What the sadhak has to seek is the full opening to the divine, the psychic change of his consciousness, the spiritual change. Of that change of consciousness. This is what we will read and then pause and we'll continue from there. What Shrivindu is telling us, what is required of us? Opening to the divine, selflessness, great demand, difficult. Desirelessness, even more difficult. Humility, impossible. Bhakti, oh, this is all old-fashioned stuff. Surrender, this is not correct. We are individuals. Calm, equality, peace, quiet sincerity, not demonstrative sincerity. I am here for 40 years and you know I have done this. Quiet sincerity are necessary constituents even to, I think, experience in some measure one of these is a great, great step forward. I just read again, full opening to the divine, selflessness, desirelessness, humility, bhakti, surrender, calm, equality, peace, quiet sincerity are necessary constituents until he has the psychic and spiritual change. To think of being supramental is an absurdity and an arrogant absurdity. There is an emphasis. Sri Aurobindo is not known for too much of emphasis, you know, like that. He is putting an emphasis that it's an absurdity, and then he says it's an arrogant absurdity. All these egoistic ideas, if indulged, can only aggrandize the ego. That's what they show with Ravana having 10 heads. Spoil the sadhana, whatever little chance we have, that is gone, and lead to serious spiritual dangers. They should be rejected all together. So we can have a quick 10-15 minutes interaction. I'm sorry, I mean, I don't know how to really proceed, so but it's okay, we need Sri Aurobindo and the mother, so. Yes, I thought we'll take this as a full subject, yeah, because it's a very, very important fundamental of the sadhana, so maybe another session will, yes. Yes, that's true. Actually, that touches the point of equality. With regard to, this is a letter written in context of people, and you know, when sometimes, say a teacher, now he has to, I'm giving a commonplace example, he's called upon to judge the student. Now judge is a word we use, but I mean he has no choice, but he has to observe. Similarly, when a departmental head, he cannot say that everything is okay, you know, whatever anybody is doing. Similarly in life, sometimes we have to observe. It is very good to and needed to observe, because otherwise one can be very easily misled by very beautiful words, because you know our mind can always weave things. So to learn to observe correctly human nature, its various movements, is fine, but it should not be done, you know, in a spirit where you condemn the human being, as you know, that's where the sympathy word comes in. That because you have observed something, that means the person is gone for good. Nobody is gone for good. Everybody, mother is seeing to it, and she will take care in her own way. And the best way is to even suggest that if you open to her, she takes care of everything. So that is being in sympathy. Also to know that we all have our difficulties with which we struggle. Nevertheless, again, impartiality is when it's not an egoistic standpoint. Our standpoint is, if somebody appreciates me, then all that the person says is good or right. If a person is my friend, then invariably I take it for granted that the person, I have to support the person. These are very unconscious biases in human nature, which are so natural that we don't even observe it. Sometimes I have a certain cherished opinion and the other person voices a similar opinion and I hold it right because I am holding on to my preferred opinion by my ego. So there are so many ways where we are partial, even where we look impartial. But to be impartial is to use only one light and one standard. Now in this particular yoga we can say to see it in the mother's light, as simple as that. If you don't want to look at it like that, look at it from the psychic light. The psychic light is first, is it true? Is it beautiful? Is it good? At least that's a, you know, a very simple yardstick which everybody has. But best is to see it in mother's light. What does mother and Shubhendu? For instance, now we have read this letter and anybody speaks about, you know, bringing down supramental and effecting a change. We know that the person is going towards megalomania. And you definitely feel sympathy rather than, you know, and if you are friend, it would do good to tell him that, look, I mean, this is dangerous. And if there are people who are moving around and, you know, are attracted to this, there is no harm in telling them, look, it's your business if you want to do it. But definitely this is going to land you in deep trouble. So this can be, but, you know, one need not go beyond it. So that's where probably to observe with impartiality and with sympathy, and it can go in many instances. Sometimes it can take a very different turn. There is a very interesting letter of Sri Aurobindo on equality. We can just touch that. And maybe when Sri Aurobindo was asked by Sahana Devi that somebody has talked ill of mother and Sri Aurobindo and of you and mother, and I feel a great anger rising within me, and someone said it's all right, but somebody else says it's deviation from equality, what should I do? Then Sri Aurobindo wrote his famous letter, which you know, is quoted in Letters on Yoga. I think it's the last letter in the section on works probably, and there he says that equality of neutral indifference is all right for the old yogas. But in our yoga, there is a work to be done, there is a truth to be established against which immense forces are arraigned. You know, falsehood doesn't allow this. And so, to take an active stand in favor of truth as against falsehood. In fact, he also speaks about subtle attacks against the leaders of the work, obviously referring to him and the mother. Like supposing somebody came and, I'll give a very crude example, walk to the ashram samadhi, you know, drunk, in a drunk state, and started putting a hammer over the samadhi. I would not say I am being very equal because I don't care, you know, what he does. He can put a bottle of plastic, you know, water, half drunk or even undrunk on top of the samadhi, and I'll say I should be indifferent and equal. That would be a wrong understanding of equality. Equality has to be practiced with reference to my ego. If somebody hits me a nice tight blow, I may remain untouched. That is greatness. But, you know, when there is a very obvious violation of the very fundamental principle of truth, then to say one is equal is not right. One would obviously go there and say, look, please, you know, this is not the place for keeping the bottle. Keep it down. If the person insists that he is doing the right thing, you may even have to drag him out. It's perfectly fine and in order and consistent with equality. And that's the example Sri Aurobindo in fact gives in that letter, quoting the Gita, where he says that Gita, which insists so much on equality, equally bids Arjuna to fight. So it depends on the context also. So all these things have to be practiced in reference to the ego. The purpose of equality is to get rid of the ego sense. It's not to get rid of all sense altogether. Yes, please.
You have been talking about various qualities which are needed for reaching more in the level, be one with God. But what I find from some books also, from Sanskrit, the Ashwapati has been selected, though a lot of thousands and lakhs of people are there. You must select it by the Almighty to do that work. Similarly, Anirudh Jain, those thousands of
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, please be seated. Well, Ashupati and Shurbindo, as in Savitri itself it is said, who is Ashupati? One in the front of the immemorial quest. So he is a pioneer. And who is he? He who wears the human cloak in which disguises the all-knowing guide. So Ashupati is an avatar. And similarly, Shurbindo, he is an avatar. Now, avatar puts on the human nature precisely because we can put on the divine nature. So definitely Shurbindo and Ashupati are special cases, if one may say so, not because they are chosen, but because they have chosen to come down and take on the human nature. So there is a difference between a conscious descent, which avatar is, and a chosen human vessel. Chosen human vessel is there, you know, something like, you know, one can speak of Nalnida and Nirodha and all these Champaklalji who were there, you know, they were definitely chosen vessels. Now, why they have been chosen? If we ask, we will know the divine logic. For instance, there is someone whose outer nature one cannot understand, but the mother has chosen. So she speaks that it's to your soul, you know, she sees that truth manifesting through it, or she sees the truth of the being, and she has to bring that out. And sometimes these beings can take upon themselves a great difficulty. So about one such person, obviously no names, but if you see this person from the outside, you get a feeling that this person is completely entrenched in the most material mind. He cannot understand anything beyond gross physical facts. But mother has chosen him as someone very close and very close to mother. And mother has written a line about him that he represents the material man, but with the capacity to be psychicized. Now you see, there are two sides of truth of human beings, the nature and the soul. The divine sees the soul, man sees the nature. And that is why there is a famous story of why Arjuna is chosen for the Gita. Why not Yudhishthir? Yudhishthir is a great satyavadi, you know, he never tells a lie. Arjuna is not known to be so truthful. Yudhishthir is absolutely, he is faithful, he is, you know, married to Draupadi, you know, that too has a sharing and he sticks to her. Arjuna goes around, Arjuna has three, you know, wives, thrice married. Arjuna has his own problems, his own weaknesses, but Arjuna is chosen. Now why is Arjuna chosen? Because there is something in him, in his psychic consciousness, which is very profound. And what is that? When a choice comes, whether you accept the whole army or Krishna, Arjuna is very clear. He says, let army, victory, all this go wherever they want. I want Krishna, just for the delight of your company. Now that's the truth of Arjuna's soul. But the truth of Arjuna's nature, if you see outwardly, not that he is a great being, not that he is an ordinary mortal, he is skillful, he is perfect in concentration, but he is less truthful than Yudhishthir, less meditative than Sahadev, less strong than Bhima, less Mahatma than Vidur. He can fly into a rage. He makes all kinds of promises which he is unable to keep. Yet he is chosen. So this choice is based on something very intrinsic and fundamental, which is true of the soul of the human being. We don't know it either about ourselves or about others, why we have been chosen and brought to this path. Sometimes we may even feel we are the most horrible creature samples. There are so many beautiful beings. But this is an error of perception. When someone asks Aurobindo, Nirodha in fact, I wish you had disciples like Swami Vivekananda. So Aurobindo says, as to the disciples, I agree that I have a lot. Of course, he uses the word kismat, you know. But then he says something very interesting. He says, but as to Vivekananda, we do not know whether he would agree to this kind of an effort. And we do not know if he took to this yoga, whether he will not break down under the pressure and the ordinary humanity will not begin to show. And this is for someone as great and leonine as Vivekananda, undoubtedly a great yogin. So we do not know what is, this is something which only the divine knows. But Aurobindo's and the mother's instance, they are special descendants. So it's not they are chosen, they have chosen. I think we will close with this and continue next week. Thank you. I think we will